I always wanted to know who the best player was on tour simply because I wanted to actually work as hard. And then I ran into a little guy by the name of George Knutson out of Canada. And I watched him hit the golf ball. I watched him with the wide stance, taking the club back way inside, releasing the club. One of the greatest ball strikers I'd ever seen.
Now Ballesteros. With a putt that could win him the 113th British Open.
Hello and welcome to the brand new edition of the Mackellar Golf Podcast. My name is Lawrence Dornigan and this week I'm joined by my new co-host, Mr. Mark Cannizzaro of the New York Post. But before we get to Mark, I have to do a quick bit of selling. The latest edition of Mackellar Magazine number 3 is still available on the website, mackellarmagazine.com. Go there and get yourself a copy. You can also get, we have relaunched our store in which we have all sorts of beautiful t-shirts, including our brand new t-shirt with our brand new slogan, Mackellar, fast play, slow journalism. You get there, a beautiful red heather t-shirt, on you go. Very, very fashionable. You can also get, for these COVID times, you can get a Mackellar logoed gator mask. Easy slip on your face, slip off when the mood takes you or when the occasion is appropriate. Go to mackellarmagazine.com. That's probably enough selling. So we'll get on with the show. Mark, how you doing, pal?
I am doing fantastic, Lawrence. I just saw some, you know, one of the best finishes we've seen in years in a major championship. So, and I was, you know, fortunate enough to be here in San Francisco seeing it live.
You are, I don't lie, you are sitting in your room at the Cal Club. How's the Cal Club looking at 9 o'clock on a Saturday, on a Sunday night?
I might be the only person in the clubhouse right now, but it's looking just fine.
Are you, you're not tempted to go out and play, put a miner's helmet on and go play 18 holes?
I would not put it past myself, except that I've got this podcast to do, and I'm still having some dinner, it's a beautiful place here. Obviously, you played here before, and I've been fortunate enough to stay here. I've got a good friend of mine who's a member and is hosting me to stay in the in one of the guest rooms in the clubhouse, so I'm more than fortunate.
Mark, we couldn't do a show with just the two of us. Got on a guest. Do you want to introduce a guest this week?
I would love to. It's a good friend of mine and soon to be a closer friend of yours, Lawrence. Evan Priest, who is, I know he's in Sydney right now in Australia, does a million things, including working for the Australian Associated Press and many other magazine ventures, and hopefully maybe some Mackellar projects, Lawrence, I would hope, in the future.
I'm not sure we can afford you. Can we afford you, Evan?
I'll be able to make a discount for someone I like. So I really appreciate the intro, guys. I've listened to the podcast for a while. I'm excited to be on it.
Here, we'll crack straight in with the big news of the day. Evan, Gabby Ruffles lost in the final of the US Women's Amateur. Devastating.
Yeah, it was devastating scenes, and even more devastating just the way it happened. You know, it was such a thrilling final that went to two extra holes, and on that second extra hole, Rose Zhang, that she was conceded a par, and Gabby had a delicate chip, which she absolutely executed to perfection, and then had this tricky little downhill putt, which basically lipped out. It was almost a horseshoe, not quite, but almost, and it was just a devastating way to lose lose a U.S. Women's Amateur. And in the meantime, she was chasing history. She was trying to be, I think, the sixth player to win back-to-back U.S. Women's Amateurs and the first since Danielle Kang did that almost 10 years ago. So heartbreaking stuff that, as Kari Webb took to Twitter a couple of hours ago to reaffirm that, you know, her star is going to continue to rise. She's going to be the future of Australian golf for years to come.
I mean, obviously, that not the biggest news today, but I've been a very close follower of the Ryan, our brother. I think I saw him play in the Asia Pacific Amateur. I couldn't believe his swing. What a player he is! I think he's on the Corn Ferry Tour. Anyway, just tell us quickly. Gabby Ruffles, she's not been playing long, has she?
No, she was actually a top-ranked junior tennis player in Australia, and of course, her parents, you know, were tennis stars in themselves. Her father, Ray Ruffles, was a professional tennis player on the men's tour and ended up coaching the Australian tennis side. And then her mother, who was actually an American, was a USC Trojan and two-time, I think, doubles winner on the WTA Tour. And so, you know, for the first 15 years of her life, Gabby sort of followed that path, but she fell out of love with tennis. And all the while, Ryan was becoming one of the most high-profile junior golfers in the country. And so she kind of followed in her brother's footsteps and fell in love with the game. And in 6 years, she's accomplished so much. It's just mind-boggling.
Here, Mark, compared to 6 years ago, what are you like as a player?
I'm a much more mature player. I have to say, the seriousness, I actually just, when I got back to my room and had the Golf Channel on, I saw an interview with Ruffles, and she really, you could tell she was pretty shaken from the loss, but very, very classy.
Yeah.
You know, for a young lady like that. And not to turn this into an entire women's golf podcast,
I know.
But you see what happened to Lydia Ko today. I think what she lost a 4-shot lead in the last five holes on the LPGA Tour, and she hasn't won in, I don't know, 40 or 49 or 50 tournaments. And this is a woman that was like unstoppable just a couple few years ago. So actually, it was a pretty active day in women's golf as well.
Yeah, it was actually a brilliant day. I'm afraid to say, Evan, I slightly had my tongue in cheek with the. But I mean, that was it's a good story, big story. Gabby Ruffles is a great player. She's going to be a great pro. But the big story of the day, obviously, Colin Morikawa wins the PGA Championship at Harding Park. Mark, you were there. Can you just paint a picture of the day? Actually, watching it on TV, there seemed to be a lot of people in the premises. How did that happen?
You know, it's funny you mention that, Lawrence, because I have to say, it was not a good look at the end. I don't know if you noticed in the interview session, Steph Curry was in there. I mean, you know, if you're the PGA of America and you haven't allowed fans in the place all week, and Steph Curry is sashaying in, not only on the grounds but into a lockdown media corral area where we're barely allowed into without credential to ask the first question. I get it; it's entertainment and all that kind of stuff, but I thought it was a bad look, to be honest with you. But yeah, I had a couple of texts from some people mentioning that, and it's true. I noticed that on Thursday I walked with Tiger in his first round, and there was actually a gallery following him. And I said to a couple of my colleagues, "Who are these people?" But and I really don't. I mean, some of them were volunteers, but you know, as what happens with all these things, is always, you know, and what's surprising now, because it shouldn't be at this point now in this coronavirus lockdown. But there's always people at these things that, quote unquote, don't belong, or maybe that's being a little bit harsh, but you know, they're certainly not really authorized, so to speak. Now, I don't know where these people came from, but there was a line of people to congratulate Colin Morikawa when he came off at 18. I mean, it looked like they had as many volunteers and all their volunteers jackets as if they had full fans here all week. So I don't know where all these volunteers were doing, but yeah, it was a very weird day. There were a decent amount of people there, and like I said, the Steph Curry thing I thought was a bad look for the PGA of America, because, you know, we're supposed to be all about the bubble and, you know, trying to keep people, you know, on lockdown here and no fans and all that stuff. And now you got, you know, Steph Curry in here, not only watching the golf and following it, you know, following Morikawa, but, you know, in a restricted media interview area to ask a question. So I thought that was a bit over the top.
Here, Evan, you've been to a million press you've been to a million press conferences. What did you think of Steph Curry's question?
Yeah, I was just about to ask you guys sort of what you thought about it, because, you know, I'm an NBA fan. I love Steph Curry, and I sort of didn't mind it too much. But having said that, I found myself getting quite annoyed when Carson Daly was, you know, gate crashing a couple of press conferences with Rory and sort of talking about their podcast. And then I think we had the same thing with Jimmy Fallon planting questions during the Players' Championship, and that wasn't a very good look for the tour. So I sort of don't know where I sit on this whole celebrity gate-crashing press conferences stuff. It, you know, it can be done tastefully, but at the same time, it can be a real, you know, it sort of demeans our job a little bit, I guess.
Well, Evan, if I could jump in for a second, Lawrence. I understand the gate-crashing and the entertainment value, but this is COVID-19, no fans allowed at any golf tournaments for the last 2 months. You know what I'm saying? That's my problem with that. More so, I get it that we're going to be second fiddle to the entertainment stuff. You know, that's where we in the media, it's going to sound like me bitching and moaning, which I suppose I am, but we're all being pushed out anyway to a large degree in all sports, not just golf. But the bottom line here, the problem I had with this, guys, was there was no fans allowed. So what the hell was Steph Curry doing in there?
It's a good question. Yeah, I suppose the biggest issue is the COVID stuff. I mean, we were just robbed of a major championship having the atmosphere that it would normally have. But then to see that many people standing around the 18th green and then for a celebrity to be in a, you know, designated media section, it was just a bit bizarre, wasn't it?
The do you remember, Evan, I don't know if you remember, if you do, Mark, the PGA Tour had an idea for putting the press into a glass, essentially a glass box, so the fans could kind of eavesdrop and see what a real press conference looked like.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Well,
I've experienced that in football because they've tried that in football, Lauren. You know, with the Jets and Giants, with their new stadium at MetLife Stadium, they had us in a glassed-in area. So all of the rich people that with the luxury suite seats, we felt like circus animals in there. Everybody was like staring at us, asking questions. You know, it was just that didn't last very long, by the way, because people started yelling in the door and not behaving, so to speak. But whatever. I mean, listen, we have some of the greatest jobs in the world, and I'm not going to sit here and bitch about it. You know, with what we do, but you know, the challenges get greater every day. You know, as the new world evolves.
Well, here's the thing: the only time that is warranted would be that new media center at Augusta National, where people want to come through and see how journalists cover the Masters, and they want to see that brand spanking new press building. And that's about the only time that I would be interested, if I was outside the media, in seeing how reporters go about their business.
I would not want to see reporters eating their lunch, and I mean, my goodness, that's not entertainment. That's the opposite of entertainment. Here, I don't know. Have you ever been on the premises at Harding Park, Evan? I don't know if did you cover the match play in 2015?
No, I actually wasn't in the United States just as of yet. I came the year after that, but I did play Harding Park for the media day, which it was just after the Pebble Beach Pro-Am this year.
Yeah.
So myself and a couple of colleagues, Benny Everill and Mike McAllister from PGAtour.com, and I think Alex Maselli was there as well. We went and played Harding Park, and I just remember thinking at the time, like, man, that rough is going to be thick once it comes to summer in Northern California, and it's going to play. It's going to be a good test of golf, and it turned out that, you know, the winning score, 13 under, it really proved true.
Because you turn up to Harding Park on a normal day, and obviously the rough, they haven't prepped it for tournament play, Mark. But you pitch up there and you think, oh my goodness, the pros would absolutely annihilate this place if they ever got the chance. But as Evan says, lo and behold, it kind of stood up pretty well, didn't it?
Well, Lawrence, you know, you and I played there in January when I was out here for the NFL playoffs to cover the 49ers. And I got to tell you, I was kind of nonplussed. You know, I mean, it was and already there, they, at that point back in January, they had already pinched the fairways in. The rough was pretty juicy. But I thought the layout was not that exciting to me other than a handful of holes, not to be a buzzkill or anything like that. But I have to say, I really appreciated it this week, walking around. I had a different appreciation for it. And what you just said there a moment ago about thinking the players would devour it, I think that really you got to throw credit to Kerry Haig, who sets these things up for the PGA of America, who is, you know, known by everybody in the business as the best at what he does here. I mean, we criticize the USGA so often for their ridiculous setups and whatnot, and but Kerry Haig seems to always get it right, and man, he got it right this week, didn't he? I mean, that's the number you want to win, you know, a golf tournament, right around 9, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 under par, right?
Yes, he did a brilliant podcast with Andy from the Fried Egg. It can't be that hard, Evan, can it? I mean, he seems to do it every year. I mean, why did the USGA make a mess of it every year?
Yeah, I mean, I can't even remember who it was that said it, but, you know, the R&A do the best job of it, I think, in terms of just they set the course up and they let Mother Nature dictate the rest, and that's exactly how it should be done, and that's exactly how it kind of unfolded this week in San Francisco.
And the golf course, 2015, Rory beat Gary Woodland in the final in the match play, but that was a pretty good year. 2005, I always say this, was the best golf tournament I ever attended. The Amex, it was a WGC event. I'll never forget, John Daly played with Monty, who was not quite in his pomp, but he was a good player on the final day, and I followed those two rounds, and it was just magnificent. Amazing fans. It was a brilliant leaderboard. Daly lost to Tiger Woods in a playoff. Obviously it was a great week, and we'll come on to it in a second, but the fans that week in San Francisco, golf fans, were amazing. I just wonder, Evan, you watch him from afar. What did you make of the whole thing as a spectacle without spectators?
It was very bizarre, wasn't it? But I suppose on the same token, we're used to it after, what's it now, 9-10 weeks without fans. So the first round, I really had that feeling that it didn't feel any different from a regular PGA Tour event. But as the tournament unfolded, particularly Friday, Saturday, and of course Sunday today, it really sort of became a major championship and really came of age, didn't it? It was, of course, it was bizarre and it lacked the roars. And if we look back at it in a couple of years' time, we'll probably think, oh, you know, what a shame that Colin Morikawa, you know, didn't have fans to witness him win his maiden major championship in such dramatic fashion. But right now, right here and there, it feels like the best major championship finish that I've seen, probably since Tiger Woods last year. And then before that, I can't even remember the last major. I thought this was exciting, such a grandstand finish.
Well, we're much older and wiser than you. Just sit back, and Mark and I will go back into the depths of history. Here, before we do that, Mark, you were on the premises. Surreal, fine. I mean, what did you think? I mean, was it weird? I don't know.
Well, I would echo. See, this is my fourth tournament that I've covered since the PGA Tour restarted. I was down in Colonial for the first start back. That, to me, was the most bizarre, just because, A, I was leaving the bubble of my own home for the first time in 3 months, and, you know, and B, just because, you know, it was the first time actually, you know, back to covering a live sporting event. And so I've gotten a little used to it. You know, I did Travelers, I drove out to Ohio and did Memorial. So I've gotten a little bit used to the weird, you know, quietness, the eerie quiet, really, out there. But the fact that this was a major, it struck me a little bit more this week, Lawrence and Evan, and particularly when you think about what that reaction would have been on 16, and we'll talk about it in a moment or two, when Morikawa drives that green on 16 and eagles and basically surges away from the field, that place would have gone absolutely berserk, and you just didn't have that, you missed that, you know, and. You know, that's not going to take any shine off the Wanamaker Trophy for Morikawa, I can tell you that. But, listen, we're getting used to it, and hopefully it'll change in due time. But yeah, it's a bizarre feeling just kind of walking out around in the quiet of that golf course and seeing guys make great shots and just hearing nothing.
What's the interaction like with the players? Were you chatting to them during the rounds, or were you too far away? Were you allowed inside the ropes?
No, we're not inside the ropes, but you know, it is a little bit more intimate. You know, if you're standing at a tee box, obviously there's, you know, you don't really need to be inside the ropes, which we normally are, because the point of being inside the ropes is so we can see in front of the fans. But there's no fans, so I mean, there were a couple of times where I would be at a tee box. In fact, I was walking with Bryson yesterday during some of his round, and you know, because I thought maybe he was kind of poised to make a run, and. We kind of got to the 11th tee box, and I was just on the other side of the rope, and it was Bryson, his caddy, and me, and his playing partner, Patrick Reed, and his caddy, and Bryson just caught my eye and kind of nodded, and I gave him a little you know thumbs up and whatever, you know.
Oh, thumbs up! Come on, well, what's wrong with you?
It wasn't a thumbs up; it was just kind of a wave. Okay, is that better for you?
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, it wasn't a thumb. Actually, it was a peace sign, because that's how I roll. But
do you think the players were digging it, or would the players have preferred fans in?
The players absolutely prefer fans. There's no question. Really? But really? the one thing I will say though is it takes a little away from the grind of the week. I'll use Mickelson as an example, because that guy signs more autographs, as we all know, than anybody. And you know, that takes a lot out of guys, you know, or just being asked even. But, you know, Phil will sit there for 30 minutes after his round and do that. And you can maneuver around the golf course a lot easier without the fans, you know. So, I've heard a couple of comments from some players that I've talked to during the week about that. But they're very, very quick to say, listen, we want the fans out here. At the end of the day, the benefit and the preference to have the fans certainly outweighs those couple little conveniences that you have if you're a player when there's no fans on the premises.
It was it doesn't make for good TV. It doesn't make for a good look on TV, Evan, does it? I mean, all the, it just looks beer.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, the last golf tournament that I can remember with no fans, or even the last competitive round, was, I think it was the third round of the Zozo Championship in Tokyo, which I was fortunate enough to be there to cover Tiger Woods make history. And after the first, you know, I was really there for the build-up throughout the whole week, and it was just hysteria because you had the Rugby World Cup going on in Tokyo. There was such a buzz about Tiger Woods being there, and then of course, Jason won the skins on the Monday. The Thursday was incredible. The Friday was washed out, and then Saturday it was just this really strange, bizarre round where Tiger Woods was leading a golf tournament. There was no one there to witness it. So yeah. I'm definitely not a fan of having no fans, and excuse the pun, at golf tournaments. And it seems like some of the players are really struggling without them.
Well, it's interesting, Lawrence. Rory McIlroy has been very, very transparent in the recent weeks, talking about the fact that he has a hard time keeping his focus without the fans, because they kind of keep him dialed in, and he says he finds his mind wandering a little bit. Paul Casey yesterday was really almost impassioned talking about how he misses the fans, how it's almost like not fun without playing in front of the fans. So you've got a lot of guys that it does affect. There's no question about it, as Evan said. I mean, you got the lesser guys that are kind of used to having, you know, three people, a girlfriend or a wife or a couple of people following them. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, for the bigger players, you know, these guys get jacked up, you know, and you know, Rory from the start has said it's been difficult for him. And Paul Casey really yesterday, I don't know if you saw his interview, but he really was very impassioned about it, to the point where he was like, it's like almost no fun, you know, and he wasn't trying to be a kind of a overprivileged golfer complaining. He was just being really, really honest.
Well, I was chatting to Mark Leishman just ahead of the PGA Championship, and he made a really salient point in that it's not just when a golfer is in contention and they need the energy from the crowd. It's actually when they're Friday afternoon, they're a couple of strokes outside the cut line and they're really grinding to make it, or just they're not playing well in general, and the fans really sort of lift them up and spur them on to sort of finish the round strong. So some of the guys that aren't playing well, it's really affecting them too, not just the big guys who are in contention.
Yeah. Anyway, it didn't stop them producing a phenomenal tournament. We'll get to Sunday. So we're talking on Sunday evening. Sunday morning, it was like Christmas morning getting up. It was obviously, you don't have Tiger there, although we'll maybe brush on him in a little bit. No Rory, no Tiger. That's the two biggest names in golf these days, and neither were in contention this morning. But still, it was a great leaderboard. Dustin Johnson leading by one from Cameron Champ, Scottie Scheffler, Casey, Kepka, Morikawa, and seven, two behind. Then you had Berger, Day, DeChambeau, Funau, Fleetwood, and Justin Rose. Hell of a leaderboard, Mark, isn't it?
It was a great leaderboard, Lawrence. And when you look at that leaderboard, listen, I mean, there were a lot of guys that left that golf course heartbroken, ticked off, upset, certainly in awe of what Morikawa did. And to a man, you know, everybody was all praise. But what was interesting about this tournament, Lawrence, was, and this is probably my favorite element to what happened on Sunday. Nobody really lost this golf tournament.
Yeah,
Colin Morikawa seized the golf tournament. Now, you can look at Dustin Johnson, who now is 0 for 4, you know, in trying to convert 54-hole major championship leads, which is the first time anybody's ever, you know, hit that dubious distinction, unfortunately. And Dustin didn't play great today. He shot 2-under. He birdied 18, so it was a bit of a backdoor 2-under. But it's not like he was hitting the ball all over the yard. You know what I mean? He just didn't seize the moment. Now, you know, interestingly, if I can transition for a quick moment, Brooks Koepka played miserably today. And I, if you're a fan of karma, you may be happy about that, because, you know, Brooks on Saturday night after the round was over, I think very curiously and kind of shockingly trolled Dustin Johnson, who's supposed to be his buddy, when he did a few interviews on television and with us in the print media, basically kind of chiding the fact that, well, you know, listen, I've got a bunch of these things. I've been in this position before and been successful. I like my chances. Dustin Johnson, he's only got one major. He's been in this situation a number of times and hasn't converted. I thought that was over the top, in my opinion, on Saturday night. And I thought, you know, good for Koepka. He shot, I think, 3 or 4 over par today and tumbled out of contention today with a chance to make history. First guy in almost 90 plus years to win 3 PGA championships in a row. So I think karma is a bitch for him on Sunday.
Yeah, it was a It was a kind of weird. I guess he just thought he was having a laugh, Evan.
I don't know, Lawrence. It wasn't a smirk. It wasn't a smirky kind of thing. I think it was a head game thing. I thought he was playing a head game a little bit, in my opinion. And the other thing that's interesting is he did an interview with Golf Week. I think it might have been I can't remember who it was. I mean, he did an interview with Golf Week.
It was Golf Week.
It was Eamon. I'm sorry,
it
Eamon
was.
Lynch.
Yeah, Golf
Week. Yeah. So Eamon. So he did. He basically said, I'm not really friends with anybody on tour, because Eamon kind of mentioned well, what about Dustin Johnson? Everybody talks about. Kepka made it sound like that his and Dustin Johnson's supposed friendship was a media manufactured friendship, and that really all they did was really do work out together a few times, and they don't even do that anymore. So he's just, I mean, listen, I love the fact that Kepka speaks his mind. We in the business we're in, we love guys like that and athletes like that, because we don't want the cookie cutter, afraid of their own shadow people. I just think in this particular scenario, I thought Brooks Kepka went over the top, and I thought he got what he deserved on Sunday.
Evan, you're a much better reader of people than Mark is. I mean, you're a real true psychologist. What was Kepka at then? What do you think he was at? It was weird, wasn't it?
I've seen it before. It's just the age-old Saturday night sleep. Someone's sleeping on the lead, you try to give them something to think about as they're rolling off, putting their head on the pillow and trying to make them obsess over that before they get to the first tee on Sunday. And obviously, as Mark just said, it was just a complete failure of an attempt to do that. GJ doesn't think about much at the best of times, and I doubt he was thinking about that on Saturday night. And he got his karma. It was a pretty miserable 74 there, wasn't it? For someone who has such big credentials on the major stage, that was a pretty poor final round.
Let me tell you something as well now, Lawrence. I'm not sure, you probably aren't even aware of this, but Rory spoke after his round today, and he was highly critical of the way that Brooks conducted himself there. And he basically said, look, he goes, I respect everybody. He goes, how can you disrespect somebody that's 21 PGA Tour wins?
Yeah.
And he also said, yeah, listen, I know those guys, maybe don't see each other eye to eye. I get that, whatever, but Rory and Brooks. But the bottom line is, I thought Rory had a great point. I mean, it's you're going out on a limb to disrespect a guy that's got a major championship. I get it. And maybe he's supposed to have a few more the way his talent is and the position he's put himself in. But the bottom line is, he's already a Hall of Famer at this point if his career ends today. So, but I thought Rory was pretty pointed. He said he was very taken aback when he saw those comments.
Yeah, I did see that. I pay attention, Mark. I did see that. Well said by Rory. Here, by the way, on Dustin Johnson, wait to hear this, Evan. He holed a birdie putt on the last hole that took him out of a six-way tie for third and a two-way tie for second. He went from $468,000 to $968,000 with that one putt, that one birdie putt. That is mind-blowing, isn't it?
It was a pretty timely putt, but as Mark pointed out just before, it was a little bit of a backdoor putt, wasn't it? Kind of at the time, it didn't mean anything except for about $500,000. And if only he had made one of those sort of coming earlier down the stretch, it would have been a lot better.
Some backdoor putt, Mark, 500 grand.
Well, I bet he'd trade that 500 grand in for the Wanamaker Trophy.
Yeah, I guess. Here, a couple other. Actually, Jason Day, we'll come to Morikawa. Just a couple other names. DeChambeau. But Jason Day, I think you spoke to Day after the round, didn't you, Evan?
I did, yeah. Obviously he's a little bit devastated, but I think that most of the guys in the field today just felt they were outplayed. So there wasn't too much to be disappointed about. No one really threw away the golf tournament. So Jason was, pretty buoyed, sort of thinking about the US Open, thinking about the Masters. The Masters is the major that he wants to win the most. And he's just, excited, and he feels a little bit freer. And now that he's got four top tens in a row on the PGA Tour, he's sort of playing more towards like he was in 2016. He's really excited. He feels that he's really found something.
Of course, he probably thought he'd thrown away the golf tournament, 16, 17, 18. But then he finishes at 10. He's actually well out of the golf tournament. He finishes three behind. Has he fired his coach? Is he on his own now? Day, has he fired his coach?
Yeah, he split with Colin a few weeks ago, and I actually spoke to Colin a couple of days ago. And, whether or not you read into any speculation about if it was a disagreement or not, the fact of the matter is it was a mutual split. After 20 years, Colin said that he always saw an end coming. Nobody ever coaches a player, throughout their entire career, or if they do, it's a very rare occasion. So for Jason, he kind of absorbed all that knowledge that he had got from Colin since the age of 12 or 13 years of age at a boarding school. And now he wants to go off on his own. And I guess he just, having made that decision, it was probably weighing on him a couple of months leading up to actually making it. And now that he feels a bit freer, not suggesting that, you know, he feels free without Colin, but he feels freer having got that off his chest. It's kind of inspired him to play a lot of his best golf that I've seen in the past couple of years. So yeah, they split, and it's very sad. But Colin's an incredible coach to take someone from zero to hero like he has. I would imagine there are a lot of PGA Tour players sounding him out right now.
Yeah, I thought Day looked pretty good, although I was surprised. His putt is usually so strong, and he missed a few, you know, like those last two, 16, 17, you know, you thought you would have fancied him to hold those putts, but he didn't. Here, the other two I want to just briefly touch on, Mark, before we get to Morikawa. DeChambeau, your best friend, and Tony Finau, they played together. Actually, I noticed that DeChambeau didn't really outdrive Tony Finau that much, did he?
No, you know, it's interesting. I actually did a piece the other day, yesterday, just kind of because it was a theme this week, Lawrence. Well, it's a theme every week on the PGA Tour now, but just kind of who's the longest and whatnot. And several guys this week were talking about the fact that Tony, it was kind of between Tony and Cameron Champ as the longest, not DeChambeau. They were kind of pointed that they weren't mentioning DeChambeau as the longest. It seems like Tony Finau, if he lets it loose, and as you know, most of these guys are hitting it. Dustin Johnson, same thing. These guys are hitting it at about 70-75%. You know, in tournament competition, because they want to keep the ball in the fairway. But if they're letting it loose on the range, and just letting it fly, the consensus it really is that Finau is the longest guy out there, and Finau himself on Saturday said, yeah, I don't see anybody out driving me if I just let it loose. So, and Finau's not a cocky guy in any way. He's actually a very, you know, just a very, very respectful, humble guy. And to hear him say that, you know, was interesting. But, you know, Finau was an interesting story because I did a column on him earlier in the week, Lawrence, and he's been drawing a lot of attention with all these, you know, he's got, now this is the 31st top 10 this guy's had in since 2016 without a win. And he's got a lot of talent. He's just hasn't closed the door. This is one of those you can't really look at and say he threw it away. The guy shot 66 in the final round. You know, I mean, it would have taken a 63 to overtake Morikawa, right? So, which would have been, you know, a major championship record. So, he didn't throw this away. Again, you know, much like Dustin Johnson and DeChambeau didn't really seize the opportunity the way that Morikawa did, but. You know, this is transitioning to DeChambeau. This is his top finish in a major now. Yeah. I mean, this is a guy that's gotten a lot of publicity for, you know, bombing the ball all over the place and his weight gain and whatnot. But bottom line is he has not performed well in majors. And this was his first. I don't think he's even had a top 10 before today. And he finished tied for fourth. So he walked away from this week disappointed at not having done better. But I think he was the tone in his voice in the post match press conference today was very, very positive about what's ahead for him.
The DeChambeau 66-66 on the weekend and doesn't win at a major championship. Yeah. I mean, that's actually look at Evan, Jason Day 66, DeChambeau 66, Finau 66, Matthew Wolff 65. Matthew Wolff goes 68-65 at the weekend and doesn't win. I mean, what does that say about Morikawa's performance? Actually, Evan, before you address that, you were at the 2019 Travelers when they kind of had that introductory press conference. Was it Wolff, Morikawa, and Justin Suh? They kind of introducing them to the world, you know, hello world kind of thing. You were at that. What did you make of it at the time?
Yeah, I mean, and Victor Hovland was there as well.
Oh, Hovland, yeah.
Just being at that press conference, it was really cool to see the PGA Tour kind of wheel up these four kids that, you know, particularly three of them being Hovland, Wolff and Morikawa were supposed to be the next gen, and they've obviously proved that to be correct. But at the time, there was just something so mature and sort of serene, I guess is probably the right word, about Colin Morikawa. He just looked like he was already comfortable, and I think it might have been his, you know, second or third event on the PGA Tour. And just watching the way he conducted himself and the way he played that week and then the way he had played at the US Open at Pebble Beach, it was just something you know, when you see a player, I don't know, I mean, you guys might be able to answer this better than myself, and you might be able to name a player, but the last time you saw a player in the infancy of his career that just looks so comfortable and natural on that stage, and for me, that's Colin Morikawa.
Yeah. Actually, believe it or not, Evan, he was a member of the Cal Bears golf team, and they practice at a club that I was a member at. They would come over, and they were there every day, and Morikawa was there every day, and I have to confess, I didn't look at him twice.
Well, you know, Lawrence, he's not, you know, what's interesting about him is he is not a guy that draws your attention. You know, I mean, we talked so much all week about this, you know, Harding was going to be a bomber's paradise, right? He's the only guy at the top of that leaderboard that's not a really long hitter. And he just does everything well. And as Evan was saying, and I've had several one-on-one interviews with him over the last, you know, 8 or 9 months. I first interviewed him at Torrey Pines, and he was because he was paired with Tiger, actually, and he was so poised. I walked away from that thinking, my God, this guy has really got his head screwed on straight. And this is before he really started performing, and, you know, before he won and all that. But the guys you talk to that have gotten to know him a little bit, and Evan, I don't know if you were, I think you were on that in that interview with Scotty the other day, because Scotty was paired with him earlier in the week, and he actually played a practice round with him as well on during the, he played 9 holes with him during the week, and he said he was blown away by just the way this guy conducts himself. And when you listen to his interview, just you listen to that guy's post-tournament interview. It was a lesson in humble, poise, confidence. It was all packaged into one. I mean, he's talking about how this is just a beginning for him, and he's just gotten a taste, as if he's expecting to win a lot more majors, which I'm sure, you know, health pending, he will. But he wasn't saying it in a cocky way. You know what I mean? There's a certain way that you go about that, and it really, really impressed me.
Yeah, there were shades of Roger Federer. I mean, that's who I can think of. Roger Federer is probably the best athlete I've ever seen issue such confident statements with such a soft blow. You know, he says what's on his mind. He believes in himself, but it doesn't come across as arrogant. And just the way, I think it might have been Doug Ferguson that asked him, do you feel like you belong on this stage? His answer was along the lines of, yes, I feel comfortable. I feel like when I play my best, I can beat these guys. But just the way he delivered it, it was just so mature, and he's such an impressive player. I guess to your point about him that he does everything well. The one thing he really does excel at is his irons. And if you're a golf fan, do yourself a favor. If you're ever at a PGA Tour event and Colin Morikawa is in the field, go and watch him hit irons, because he hits his 6-iron like a sandwich. It's that ridiculous. They're just lasers.
Yeah. Right, Evan, you've seen a lot of live golf, and I don't want any lies here, okay? I want you to tell the truth. Did you look at this kid and think, major champion within a year, or major champion within 18 months? Come on.
God, no. No, not within 18 months. I definitely thought he would go on to win majors. But within 12 months, you know what I didn't see coming? I didn't see him winning 3 times in the first 14 months of his professional career. It's just insane.
Here's what I did see, Lawrence, right away, you know, with all of these young, if I'm going to pool, all, you know, with him and Wolf and Hovland, I think the one thing I noticed immediately from speaking to all three of them and watching them play is I feel like, and I'm not just saying this now because I've said it prior and I've written it before, I really feel like he has a much more sustainability. And he's going to be a steadier player. Those guys are great. And, I mean, we saw what Wolf did. Wolf almost stole this golf tournament today with that run. He was 5 under par in 4 holes, you know, around the turn. And, you know, he was the one that posted the number in the clubhouse at 10 under early. But, you know, and he's got incredible firepower. And Hovland is the same way. But I feel like Morikawa has more staying power. I think this is a guy that's going to be much more steady from week to week and major to major than any of these other younger guys.
Actually, Evan, it seemed to...
I would agree with that.
I was going to ask you, Evan, did you get a sense that this was a, quote-unquote, changing of the guard kind of major championship? You know, Mark mentioned him, you know, Morikawa, well, DeChambeau's never been up there before. Scotty Scheffler, I mean, a good player. I think he won the US Junior Ram. played in the Walker Cup, but my goodness, what I thought, I was blown away by him as well. You had Wolf, Cameron Champ. I mean, Xander Schauffele's already established, but it means a lot of quotes and quotes new names up there.
I don't think it was a changing of the guard in the sense that, you know, Colin Morikawa is a certain type of player and that we're going to see more styles like that win major championships, because you still had all the Bombers up there on the leaderboard, like you mentioned, DJ, Wolf, DeChambeau, Day, Finau. But I do think it was a bit of a changing in the guard in terms of once Colin Morikawa got that major championship off his back early in his career, you just know he's going to go on to win, you know, four of them, five of them, six of them, who knows? So in that sense, I really feel like he cemented himself as the next Jordan Spieth, the next Rory McIlroy, the next, you know, Jason Day, like a player to watch for the next 10 to 15 years.
Lawrence, you know what's kind of cool about this tournament and Sunday, in my opinion, and to what you're talking about a little bit, but not maybe not necessarily changing the guard. Tiger Woods was not in the mix all week. Rory didn't get it going all week. Justin Thomas, you know, who just was minted number one, you know, he never really got it going all week. John Rahm, who just lost the number one, you know, ranking to Justin Thomas, he never got it really going all week. And yet, this was a memorable major championship. Yeah. So that's kind of cool about this. Cynically speaking, you know, we're all kind of, you know, it's good for business when the big names win, right? It's good for our podcast. It's good for McKellar. It's good for the New York Post. It's good for Australian golf when Jason Day's going. But this kind of had a little bit of everything, and part of that little bit of everything was the fact that the biggest names in the game weren't necessarily at all at the top of the headlines.
Here, you mentioned his name. I can't finish this without asking Jordan Spieth. Did you see those?
Yeah. Pictures?
Oh, you see that photograph of him? I think it was after the second round on the range with Cameron McCormick. I mean, that was kind of heartbreaking, almost, wasn't it?
It's heartbreaking is the right word. Just to see such a player that grows to such meteoric heights so early in his career. And it's not just the fact that he's playing badly, but he just looks like he's not enjoying the game at the moment. And for me, I love watching Jordan Spieth play because he's slightly more relatable than, you know, your Matthew Wolfs and your Paul Casey's, your Dustin Johnsons and your Jason Days. But just to see him, I just think he needs a total reset. And I'm not suggesting anything technically. He just looks like he needs to get back to enjoying the game of golf and going out there and playing like he did when he was a kid. Because as we've seen, when he plays confidently, when he's out there like a puppy, I mean, he can win majors without trying.
I think Jordan has to he has to understand that he's only 26 years old. And it should be a lot easier to reset at 26. And whether that is, you know, the problem is he's been with Cameron McCormick for, you know, basically since he's a kid, right? So that's a, you know, you just talked to Evan a little bit about, you know, the difficulty of Swato and Jason splitting, which was, you know, those guys were, I mean, Swato was like a family member to Jason, right? So, you know, I think that, you know, Cameron McCormick is very much like that to Spieth. So it, you know, maybe Spieth is wrestling a little bit, you know, with, you know, do I really need to make a change here? But how am I going to change this? I've been with this guy since I was X years old. You know, I don't know. He, I agree with you. I'm a big Jordan Spieth fan. I feel like he does everything the right way. And he just looks miserable right now playing golf. And that's a terrible thing to see with the talent he has.
Spieth's been with McCormick since the age of 12. And he won all those majors when he was with McCormick. So you're right, Mark. It's a real, you know, it's a real tricky one.
You almost get to the point if you're, and again, I mean, I'm not trying to make psychobabble, but, you know, maybe there comes a point where Cameron McCormick should say to Jordan, you need a change. We need, you know what I mean? Why don't you step away and get some new eyes, you know, and because it's got to be, you know, 12 years old to now, I mean, and all the success he's had, it's got to be almost impossible for Jordan to make that split if he's thinking about initiating that split.
Do you know who you should go to? You should go and see Pete Cowan. Pete Cowan has taken people from the absolute bottom of the barrel. I mean, specifically Henrik Stenson. I think Pete Cowan...
Yeah, I was about to mention Henrik. He rebuilt Henrik's career, didn't he?
Yeah. But he obviously won't do that. He lives in Dallas. Pete lives in Rotherham. It's a long way between those two towns. Here, we'll wrap this up. I know you've got stuff to do, Mark. You're going out for your midnight miner's helmet 18 holes at Cal Club. the
emergency six-hole loop, Lawrence.
I'm not sure. The other thing to mention on Morikawa, Evan, is that he strokes gained putting 8.8 strokes. So I mean, because he was first in strokes gained putting, first in proximity to the hole, and I think first in something else ridiculous. Here the shot, everybody forever, evermore. I think Frank Nobilo on CBS said it was the best shot he'd ever seen or something like that. He'll remember it forever. Was that the best shot you've ever seen, Evan? And if not, what was better than that?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I've seen some good ones. And I keep... It wasn't the best shot I've ever seen. It came very close to it. But I suppose the best shot I've ever seen in person would be any shot that Tiger Woods hit on the back nine of Augusta National on Sunday last year. It was just the way... It was just a lesson in how to control a major championship. So for me... it would probably be, you know, anything from that 9-iron that Tiger hit on the 7th hole to the lag putt on the 9th hole, which really, you know, sort of kept his momentum going, to that, you know, iron shot out of the trees on the 11th hole. Any of those I would take as probably the best shots I've ever seen in person.
I've surprised myself with my own question. Now I can't think of an answer, so I'm just going to pass it on to you, Mark. Best shot you've ever seen? If not, what was?
Yeah, you know what? Here's why it was an incredible shot, but it wasn't the best shot I've ever seen because there wasn't a lot of trouble to be had if he missed it. Okay,
hang on a second. No,
listen, just hear me out. He could have put it in the trees. I get that, whatever, but I don't think there was. It was not a lot of danger there compared to what I thought was the best shot I've ever seen, which was Mickelson's 6-iron through the trees at Augusta. Because you're hitting over Ray's Creek, and there were just more consequences that could have been disastrous on that particular shot. And the degree of difficulty of that shot was much more. It was on the pine needles. He had to thread the needle between two trees. And his caddy at the time, Bones Mackay, was trying to talk him out of making the shot. All right, so I would say that was the greatest shot I've ever seen because of the consequences and the end result. I'm not suggesting that there was no trouble at all on Morikawa's shot on 16 here today, but I just don't think the danger was lurking as severe.
I guess today, I mean, he hits a fade naturally, Morikawa, so that probably played into his hands. But trees right. I saw Phil Mickelson hit his tee shot in the hazard left, Mark. So, I mean, that was certainly in play. 70th hole of a major championship. It wasn't like... I better take the shot on, otherwise I'm not going to get close to the leader. I mean, I think he was tied for the lead at the time, or he might have been one shot ahead. I can't remember.
He was tied. Casey had just tied him with a birdie on that
hole.
That's
right. Yeah. So, the consequences of a bad shot were, I guess, a short par four. If he hits it in the trees right, then he probably bet himself to at least get in with a four. I'm guessing there weren't many bogeys on that hole, but what a shot. Actually, right after it, Scottie Scheffler, his took a harder bounce at the front of the green, but that was an equally good shot as well.
I think that, you know, just getting back to the course setup, I love, and Paul Casey was talked about this after the round today too. I love short par fours, the risk-reward stuff and the excitement that it gives you. And all week long, that golf hole, Lawrence, was lurking as a hole that was one way or the other going to decide this championship, and it did today.
I played that hole a million times, Evan, and I just, you know, drive it down the middle and hopefully you don't put it in the trees. You got 100 yards in, but I'm thinking, having seen that today, people are going to come, you know, they're not going to come from all around the world to play Harding Park, but if they find themselves in San Francisco and they go and play in Harding Park, they will pause and reflect on the moment when they play that hole. That hole will be forever famous because of that shot. Yeah,
that's great. He immortalized that hole. You're right. That's a great point, Lawrence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that drive was just as clutch as you can get. 293 yards, cozies up there nicely to 7 feet. But then also to make the putt, it just showed someone who's willing to step it up on this stage.
Putt was pure too. They had a great shot on television. That thing never left the line. It was, I mean, that was right in the center of the hole, wasn't it? There was no hesitation.
Anyway, we'll kind of wrap
the show. Putt for dough.
Oh, hey, that's not true, by the way. That's not true, Evan. Mark Brody proved that it wasn't true. Here, we'll wrap it up here. I want to ask one more question of each of you. You go first, Evan. The best major, you're going to say Tiger last year at Augusta, aren't you? I'm excluding that. You're not allowed to say that. Best major you've ever seen?
Okay.
If not, apart from Augusta 2019, what other one would come close to that? And certainly, let's say, in recent times at least.
Well, I wasn't there in person, but I was cheering on from television back in Australia. But it was the 2013 Masters. And that doesn't, you know, obviously I'm going to say that because I'm an Australian and Adam Scott was the first Australian to win the Masters. But, I mean, there were three Aussies tied within, you know, within a shot of the lead with six holes to go. That playoff with Arnie, that Masters had as much as you could want. And if you even sort of go back to 2 days before that, the Tiger drop on 15, that was the best finish to a major championship I've seen, with Adam to sort of step it up and make that putt on the 72nd hole and the famous Jim Nance call, and then of course to get it done on the second extra hole with darkness fading at Augusta on the 10th hole. That's the best finish I've ever seen.
He's so parochial, Mark, isn't he?
It's all well, we expected that.
I'm going to say, Mark, I'll jump in and then I'll let you finish, but I'm going to say the this might be the best one because it had everything. It had all different types of players, you know, young, old. There was a sense to me, there was a sense of a slight sense of changing of the guard. There was lead changing the hands all the way down the back nine. There was heroes, there was villains. I was watching with the little guy and he was cheering every time DeChambeau missed a putt. He hates DeChambeau. And he had a great shot, defining, you know, career-defining shot to essentially win it. The only one I can think of that was pretty good at this kind of level was the, with a lot of guys involved, was the 2006 US Open at Wingfoot. You had Monty, you had Ogilvy, you had Mickelson. You had, who else is in there? I can't remember. Anyway,
Furyk was in there. He had a chance.
Yeah, it was. That was a brilliant, but I think this might have, I wish it had gone to the 72nd hole. It was essentially finished on the 70th hole, I think, because that gave him a three-shot lead. I mean, I know Casey didn't. Well, anyway, I think Casey. No, Casey parred the last two, I think. Anyway, but that won it for him. It took him three shots ahead of those and 10 under, anyway. Mark, you got one that's better, or are you writing this one up in your history ledger?
I love this. I love everything about this for all the things you said, Lawrence. But I think you're being seduced by the moment because it happened right in front of us. But I find for me, best maybe is not the right way to put it, but the most memorable for me were some of the maddest, craziest ones that I've seen, like Vandeveld in '99 at Carnoustie losing that lead, and '96 Masters with Greg Norman and Faldo. Those are the ones to me that I was they covered that stand out so much to me. That doesn't mean they were the best, but this was right up there just for all the reasons you said, because, you know, I love the fact that nobody threw this away, and I love the fact that, you know, it was won by somebody who seized the moment.
You're accusing me of recency bias. I'm accusing you of tragedy bias. The ones that you
guilty as charged.
Anyway, we'll leave it at the 2020 PGA Championship at Hardy Park, won by Colin Morikawa. Absolutely fantastic viewing. Glued to the TV all day. You are a very lucky man, Mark, to be one of the few, to be one of the 27,000 people who were there today.
me and Steph Curry.
Here, Evan, great to have you on, pal. Hopefully you'll come on with Mark and I again soon. We promise?
Promise, yeah. It was fun to be on. And it's all I can say is Major Championship Golf is back, and I'm glad.
Good way to finish. Mark, all the best, pal. Take care.
Sounds good. I'll talk to you both of you guys soon.
just to touch you. Then I realize it's a wide open road. It's a wide open road. Now how do you think it feels when sleeping by yourself, by yourself?
One you love, the one you love is with someone else.
In the morning, it's a
It's a wide open road.
Then I realize it's a wide.